Welcome to this presentation of Human Life International. The following talk by Dr. Brian Close is titled 10 Abortion Myths. To order copies of this talk or other pro-life and pro-family materials, or to learn more about Human Life International, please go to our website at www.hli.org or call us at 1-800-549-5433. That's 1-800-549-LIFE. Now let's proceed to our feature presentation.
The name of this presentation is Abortion Myths versus Research Realities. It was updated in March of 2013. There are many myths about abortion that are held by most members of the public, common knowledge that everyone knows, and which is completely wrong. The reason that so many people are misinformed about abortion, and the reason that many people support it, is because of the actions of what we call the mainstream media, the television news, the print media in the form of newspapers and magazines, and to a lesser degree, the entertainment media embodied by people we call celebrities. There are many glaring examples of unequal media treatment of both sides of the abortion debate. When Todd Akin made his clumsy comment on legitimate rape and abortion during the 2012 elections, ABC, CBS, and NBC ran 96 major stories focusing on the comment and treated it as a huge scandal for the Republican Party. But the media completely ignored abortionist Kermit Gosnell's House of Horrors abortion mill in Philadelphia, where he killed dozens of newborn babies by severing their spinal columns, killed an abortion patient, and made millions of dollars peddling pills on the black market. The only people in the world who don't think that the news media is grossly biased on abortion are the people who work in the media. The problem with the news media is twofold. Its members mindlessly repeat whatever pro-abortionists and population controllers tell them, and its members deliberately and consciously hide truth and indisputable scientific facts that support pro-life beliefs. The media is not biased, which means that its members unconsciously inject their personal opinions into their reporting. Its members are corrupt, which means the reporters know they're slanting the news and they uncritically repeat everything the pro-abortionists say and, in fact, actively suppress opposing viewpoints. In short, the media is an integral part of the pro-abortion movement, and its part of the overall strategy is to hide anything that will make abortion look bad and highlight and sometimes even manufacture stories that make pro-lifers look bad. Even pro-abortionists recognize and welcome this corruption. Susan Millsaps of NARAL Pro-Choice America said way back in 1991 that the media has been our best friend in this fight. They claim objectivity, but I know they're all pro-choice. And Boston Globe legal reporter Ethan Bronner wrote that, I think when abortion opponents complain about a bias in newsrooms against their cause, they're absolutely right. Opposing abortion in the eyes of most journalists is not a legitimate, civilized position in our society. In the intervening decades, of course, the situation has gotten much worse. The media usually completely ignores hundreds of thousands of pro-lifers at the annual National March for Life while writing long stories on a handful of pro-abortionists on the Supreme Court steps. It constantly talks about pro-life violence while ignoring the much greater pro-abortion violence, and it pushes its agenda relentlessly from amnesty for illegal aliens to the gay rights agenda. One of the worst examples of this corruption is its handling of abortion-related violence. For example, when Scott Roeder walked into the Lutheran church where late-term abortionist George Tiller was serving as an usher and shot him dead in 2009, the media wrote thousands of stories on the murder, portraying Tiller as a saint and the entire pro-life movement as a bunch of far-right, Bible-beating wingnuts. A few months later, when pro-abortionist Harlan Drake murdered pro-life activist Jim Poulon, the first thing the media did was dig into Poulon's background and list every time he'd ever had a brush with the law, right down to two parking tickets. They went so far as to seek out his family members in attempts to dig up dirt on him. This bias and corruption of the media is almost universal, but there are a number of primary points that media people use to promote and excuse abortion and population control activities. After decades of this barrage of misinformation and outright lies, most people accept the primary media deceptions about abortion without question. If you learn how to refute them, you'll be a powerful advocate for human life. These media myths are as follows. Number one, the world is overpopulated, so we have to have abortion and birth control. Number two, 70,000 women die each year from unsafe abortion worldwide. Number three, abortions are necessary for rape, incest, birth defects, and to save the life and health of the mother. Number four, it's her body, so she can do with it as she pleases. Number five, we really don't know when human life begins. Number six, third trimester abortions are rare or non-existent. Number seven, most Americans are pro-choice. Number eight, men have no right to speak out against abortion. Number nine, you can't legislate morality. And number 10, every child must be a wanted child. The first media myth about abortion is that the world is overpopulated, so we have to have abortion and birth control. Whenever population control people or organizations use statistics to justify their claims regarding world overpopulation, their numbers are almost always either exaggerations or outright fabrications. Their most common allegation is that 88 million people are added to the world's population each year. According to the United Nations Population Information Network, the annual world population did indeed peak at about 88 million during the time period 1985 to 1990, but it has been declining ever since. It will increase by about 64 million this year. The world population rate of increase is anticipated to continue to decline steeply until world population peaks at about 8.1 billion and then begins to decline in about the year 2045. In fact, from the current 7.1 billion, the world's population is projected to decline to about 6.2 billion by the end of the century. In other words, the population explosion is over. The second allegation is that the population of the world doubles every 37 years. Pro-abortionists and population controllers hope to frighten people into thinking that the current world population of about 7.1 billion will double to 14.2 billion by about the year 2050, double again to 28 billion by about the year 2087, and so on. But according to United Nations projections, the population of the world will never again double, as we have already seen. The Planned Parenthood Federation of America committed perhaps the ultimate in alarmist propaganda when it distributed a 1-foot square of paper that proclaimed on its borders, "If present birth rates continue, there will be one human being standing on every square foot of land on earth. Here's a square foot. Try it. Stand on it. Then take a stand for Planned Parenthood." So what Planned Parenthood was alleging is there would eventually be 1.6 quadrillion people on this earth, or 223,000 people for every single person living on the earth today. Even allegedly intelligent people have gotten caught up in the hysteria. One example is Stephen Hawking, who said, "By the year 2600, the world population will be standing shoulder to shoulder, and electricity consumption will make the earth glow red hot." Propaganda aside, the world has 236 nations with a 2013 population of about 7.1 billion for an average of 51 people per square kilometer of land. 80 of these countries protect their preborn citizens completely or allow only strictly monitored exceptions such as life of the mother, rape, incest, and birth defects or eugenics. However, these countries only have about 30% of the world's population. 112 of the world's nations offer little or no legal protection to their preborn citizens. Their laws allow either abortion on demand or the physical and mental health of the mother exceptions, which in practice means abortion on demand. The countries that offer little or no protection to preborn babies are home to about 70% of the world's people, and two of these countries, India and China, have 37% of the world's population. There are currently about 43 million surgical and medical abortions being committed in the world each year. This appalling number steadily increased to a high of about 55 million since 1960, when there are about 40 million surgical and medical abortions worldwide, then began to decrease. This means that during the period 1960 to 2013 inclusive, Surgical and medical abortionists have killed about 2.5 billion babies, a number equal to more than one-third of the world's entire living population. Abortion laws have a profound effect on the total fertility rates, or TFRs, and population growth rates of nations. Nations with abortion on demand have a much lower TFR than those that protect their preborn citizens, 2.1 children per completed family versus 3.9, and they have suffered much steeper declines in TFR since 1965. Also, nations that provide little or no protection for their preborn citizens have less than half the population growth rate than nations that protect them do, 0.94% versus 1.99%. The world's total fertility rate has plunged from 5.0 to a current figure of exactly replacement, about 2.1, and is projected to continue dropping to 1.5 or less by the year 2050. The world's population growth rate peaked at 2.04% per year in 1965 and is now growing at about 0.9% per year. It will stop growing by the year 2045 with a peak population of about 8.1 billion. Then it will begin to rapidly shrink, just as is now happening in Europe. Population controllers tend to visit huge population centers in developing countries, like Lagos, Nigeria, or Manila in the Philippines, and then tell everyone who will listen that the world is crammed full of people. This is like visiting a beehive and then telling everyone that the world is full of bees. To show how few people there are in the world, the entire population of 7.1 billion would each have 1,100 square feet if everybody lived in the state of Texas, or Chile, or France, or Zambia in Africa, or Myanmar, formerly Burma, New South Wales, a state in Australia, Qinghai Province in China, or Rajasthan and Madhya Pradesh states in India. All of this means that the population bomb may have landed, but it didn't explode. The second media myth about abortion is that 70,000 women die each year from unsafe abortion worldwide. To begin with, we have to consider the inflexible equations used by the population controllers. These are that every legal abortion is safe and that every illegal abortion is unsafe. We know this because as soon as a huge population control cartel legalizes abortion in a developing nation, they're content. They do not attempt to ensure that legalized abortion is safe. They don't monitor or train the new abortionists. They just cross the country off their list of nations that have so-called unsafe abortions. The primary numbers alleged by the Guttmacher Institute in the United States are as follows. Every pro-abortion and population control group repeats them, as does the media. Number one, there are 22 million safe abortions and 20 million unsafe abortions every year, and there are 70,000 abortion deaths a year with 8 million complications, almost all due to unsafe abortions. Population controllers think that illegal equals unsafe and that legal equals safe regarding abortion. But how can this be when the same people who perform abortions before it is legalized perform them after it's legalized? When abortion is legalized, more women die, and not only from physical complications of abortion. For example, in the United States, about 65 deaths were reported the year before abortion was legalized nationwide. Now, about a dozen women die of abortion every year that we know of, but at least 50 women are murdered every year by their husbands or boyfriends because they refuse to have abortions. See www.abortionviolence.org, a Human Life International website, for documentation. Pro-abortionists do not have science on their side, so they use an emotional appeal, claiming that thousands of poor, suffering women are dying in filthy back-alley abortion mills every year. They always grossly inflate the number of deaths when pushing for abortion legalization. For example, in Russia, way back in 1910, they claimed that 600,000 women died every year of illegal abortions. The actual number, long before penicillin was available, was 1,800. The same thing in India. They claimed 600,000 deaths when the actual number was a maximum of 1,800. In Brazil, they still claim 400,000 deaths a year when actual government figures show a maximum of 241. In Mexico, they claim 140,000 illegal abortion deaths every year. The actual number is about 150. In Africa, they say 74,000 deaths a year, the actual number about 150. In Italy, they said 20,000 deaths a year from illegal abortion, the actual number was 55. In Germany, they claimed 15,000, the actual number was less than 100. In the United States, they claim 5,000 to 10,000, the actual number was 65. In Portugal, they claim 2,000, the actual number was 12. In the United States, for example, a July 1989 USA Today editorial alleged that before Roe v. Wade, hundreds of thousands of women had illegal abortions annually, and 1 in 10 of them died. Since the number commonly alleged by pro-abortionists was 2 million illegal abortions annually, this would mean 200,000 deaths per year. Of course, the columnist was lying. According to official government figures, as far back as 1947, there were 593 abortion deaths in the United States, and the year before Roe v. Wade, there were only 65. Reformed abortionist Bernard Nathanson said, "How many deaths are we talking about when abortion was illegal? In NARAL, it was always 5,000 to 10,000 deaths a year. I confess that I knew the figures were totally false, and I suppose the others did too if they stopped to think about it. But it was a useful figure, widely accepted, so why go out of our way to correct it with honest statistics? The overriding concern was to get the abortion laws eliminated." In a nation where abortion is illegal, if a pro-abortion person alleges that there are many women dying of illegal abortions, their numbers are always created out of thin air. Always demand to see their documentation and don't be deterred by vague claims that their numbers are based on hospital statistics or estimates based on international statistics. Demand to see the actual documents. Often pro-abortionists will allege they know women who have died of illegal abortions. For example, back in 1985, NARAL decided to hold a contest called the Silent No More campaign. They hoped to gather tens of thousands of vividly written stories of women who had had illegal abortions, whose mothers, sisters, daughters, and aunts had died horribly at the hands of drunken butchers before abortion was legalized. NARAL planned to publicize these letters aggressively in order to influence public opinion on abortion. NARAL advertised widely among its 200,000 members and the public, asking for letters detailing experiences with illegal abortions. NARAL proudly claimed it had received tens of thousands of letters, but mysteriously only 68 were submitted to the Congressional Record for publication in May of 1985, and even these were of truly wretched, even horrible quality. For example, one rambling letter in the Record claimed that 35 years ago I was pregnant, my baby had died in fourth month of pregnancy, but because of abortion being illegal I couldn't have an abortion. I had to carry that dead child for 5 months before I finally aborted it myself. I carried that child for 5 agonizing months knowing I was carrying a dead child. Please legalize abortion. It must be pro-choice." Anyone knowledgeable in even the basics of fetal development or obstetrics will realize that the situation described in the above letter is, at best, dubious from both the medical and legal standpoints. It was revealing to note that most of NARAL's letters were written not by women who were in truly desperate circumstances, but by women who wanted abortion to remain legal for purely convenience reasons. NARAL and other pro-abortion groups sponsored scores of public readings all over the country, where women would stand and read their letters of victimization before crowds of weeping sympathizers. All of these letters are similar in one critical respect. The victim of illegal abortion was always anonymous. When pro-life activists in several cities asked questions about the persons in the letters, they were always met with shouts accusing them of insensitivity. The third media myth about abortions is that they're necessary for rape, incest, birth defects, and to save the life and health of the mother. In every nation of the world, pro-abortionists use these classic hard cases to agitate for abortion. Once again, they're appealing to emotions, not scientific fact. Typical abortion cases, according to the pro-abortionists, are the 44-year-old mother of 9 children with uterine cancer who will die if she has another child, the 11-year-old incest victim, the older mother carrying a baby with anencephaly who will die shortly after birth anyway, and the poor black woman on welfare. The truth is far different from what the pro-abortion propagandists tell us. According to the Guttmacher Institute, which is a research group associated with Planned Parenthood for decades, these are the real reasons that women have abortions, based upon actual interviews. I can't afford a baby now, 21%. I don't want the responsibility, 21%. A baby would change my life, 16%. I have problems with my relationship, 12%. I'm not mature enough, 11%. I have enough children, 8%. I want to keep my pregnancy secret, 1%. My boyfriend or husband forced me, 1%. The baby's deformed, 3%. I was raped, 1%. Pregnancy threatens my life or health, 1%, for a total of 5% in the hard case categories. If we analyze the statistics provided by 1.29 million women reporting their abortions in six states, we find the following reasons for abortions. Abortions for rape and incest, 0.13%. Abortions for birth defects or eugenics, 0.59%. Abortions for the mother's physical life or health, 1.03%. Abortions for the mother's mental health, 1.27%. For a total hard case percentage of 3.01%. This means total abortions for social reasons, 96.99%. While pro-abortionists tell us that abortion must remain legal for the hard cases, they never tell us that the vast majority of abortion is done for social reasons, to save the mother's lifestyle, we might say. Several abortionists have admitted this. Abortionist Lise Fortier said, "Each and every pregnancy threatens a woman's life. From a strict medical viewpoint, every pregnancy should be aborted." Abortionist Jane Hodgson said, "A medically necessary abortion is any abortion a woman asks for." Even the United Nations World Health Organization uses a sloppy terminology to justify abortion on demand all over the world. It defines health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. The pro-life arguments against even the hard cases are irrefutable. Rape and incest are the hardest of the hard cases, but once again, pro-life people are consistent in advocating the right to life of all preborn babies. We don't agitate for the death of the guilty rapist or molester. Why then must the innocent baby die? Imagine examining two newborn babies lying side by side, one conceived within a loving marriage and one conceived as a result of brutal rape or molestation, and then ask which would be considered more human. If these two babies were laid side by side, could anyone identify the one who was conceived by rape or incest? Of course not. Then why select one baby for extinction based solely upon the circumstances of his or her conception? Additionally, as we've seen in the United States, abortion is the ideal cover-up for incest because it destroys the evidence. Birth defects. Abortions for birth defects or eugenics are simple discrimination because such babies are aborted based solely on whether or not they are handicapped. This implies that born people who are handicapped have less of a right to live than those who are not handicapped or are somehow less deserving. This is happening all over the world as handicapped newborns are now being killed and starved to death. Life and health of the mother. As long ago as 1955, at a Planned Parenthood conference, the world's leading experts agreed that there is no medical condition that can be improved by aborting a woman's preborn child. As far as health is concerned, the World Health Organization definition of maternal health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, as we've previously noted. This means that a mother's health exception for abortion means abortion on demand. We might speak for a moment about the double effect. Where a baby gets stuck in the fallopian tube and can't be moved. This means that the baby will develop there, the fallopian tube will rupture, and the baby and the mother will probably die. In such cases, the intent of removing the fallopian tube with the baby inside it is not to kill the baby, but to save the life of the mother, and so is permissible. The fourth media myth about abortion is, it's her body, so she can do with it as she pleases. We pro-life people do agree that a woman does indeed have the right to control her own body, but nobody has the right to destroy another person's body, and a woman is already procreated when she conceived. The only question that remains is whether or not she will kill another person. Some will argue that the preborn child is inside the mother and is totally dependent upon her and so can be disposed of. But what is different about the newborn child who is also totally dependent upon her? Does this mean that we can kill newborn babies as well? And what about the example of astronauts in the International Space Station? They're inside the space station and they depend upon it completely. If they leave it without wearing a $1 million spacesuit, they'll die in seconds. But nobody's crazy enough to suggest that astronauts are just a part of the space station. This media myth makes no sense from a scientific viewpoint. If the baby were part of the woman's body, it should be genetically identical to her, but it is not. Also, all mothers are obviously female. About half of their children are male. How can a human being be both male and female? The mother and baby frequently have different blood types. The baby can be a different race from the mother. When the preborn child anchors itself to the uterine wall at its earliest stage of life, there is a concerted attack by white blood cells to defeat it, and the child must defend itself. The mother's immune system recognizes it as non-self. Therefore, it's not part of her body. The baby can die without the mother dying, and the mother can die without the baby dying. The baby can be rescued if he or she is viable. Finally, the baby initiates a process that culminates in its leaving the mother's body. No other part of the body does this. The fifth media myth about abortion is, we really don't know when human life begins. This is a contemptible and cowardly claim, which really means we don't care when life begins. Generally, if anyone says they don't know when life begins, they're admitting that abortion might be taking human life, but that they really don't care one way or the other. After all, if a moral person is uncertain of whether or not an action will take a human life, he'll refrain from taking that action. In matters of public safety, we always err on the side of life. As one example, say you're on a hunting trip and see bushes moving around in front of you. Pro-choice reasoning would say, go ahead and shoot at it because we really don't know if there's a person behind that bush or not. Pro-abortionists who claim that the unborn child is not alive are being unscientific and they are relying on superstitious hocus-pocus upon which to base their erroneous opinions. Every embryology and fetology textbook in existence states that human life begins at fertilization. Some examples? The developing human, clinically oriented embryology says, a zygote is the beginning of a new human being, i.e. an embryo. Langman's medical embryology says, development begins with fertilization, the process by which the male gamete, the sperm, and the female gamete, the oocyte, unite to give rise to a zygote. Before we're born, Essentials of Embryology says, the zygote formed by the union of an oocyte and a sperm is the beginning of a new human being. Often pro-abortion people use the term potential life to describe the preborn child. This is obviously a nonsense term concocted only to confuse the issue. Every entity on the face of the earth, animate or inanimate, is either alive or not alive. Bacteria, cattle, and people are alive. Clouds, rocks, and corpses are not alive. There's no in-between term because either an entity possesses a spark of life or it does not. The preborn child meets all of the scientific and legal conditions for life by the time he or she is only 5 weeks old. Beating heart, measurable brain waves, consuming nutrition, excreting wastes, and so on. Those who maintain that the preborn child is not alive must prove this if they want to kill it. But this is impossible, of course, so they simply ignore the question. The sixth media myth about abortion is that third trimester abortions are rare or non-existent. During the 1995 battle over dilation and extraction, or DNX abortions, also called partial birth abortions in the United States Congress, pro-abortionists lied over and over again about the procedure. First, they lied by saying that all of these partial birth abortions were necessary to complete a safe delivery. Then they lied when they said the unborn child always dies of anesthesia overdoses before the partial birth abortion. Then they lied when they said that the unborn child does not feel pain during the partial birth abortion procedure. Finally, they lied when they claimed that these abortions are only done in the most extreme circumstances, such as fatal birth defects, and to save the life of the mother. For example, the National Abortion Federation, which is a trade union for abortion mills, claimed that this particular procedure is used only in about 500 cases per year, generally after 20 weeks of pregnancy, and most often when there's a severe fetal anomaly or maternal health problems detected late in pregnancy. Remember that number, 500 per year. Planned Parenthood chimed in with this gem. The procedure, dilation and extraction, or DNX, is extremely rare and done only in cases when the woman's life is in danger or in cases of extreme fetal abnormality. Remember that allegation also. All partial birth abortions are done to save the mother's life or for fatal birth defects, according to Planned Parenthood. But the partial birth abortionists themselves contradict the National Abortion Federation and Planned Parenthood, showing that they're lying. Marvin Haskell, the inventor of the partial birth abortion, said that 80% of the procedures he performs are purely elective on perfectly healthy mothers who are carrying perfectly healthy babies. James McMahon says the primary reason he does partial birth abortions is for depression. Even the National Abortion Federation said in an internal memo just 2 years before it lied before Congress that most partial birth abortions are performed for such reasons as lack of money or health insurance, social psychological crises, lack of knowledge about human reproduction, etc. Third trimester abortionist George Tiller said at the 1995 National Abortion Federation conference in New Orleans that we have some experience with late terminations, about 10,000 patients between 24 and 36 weeks, and something like 800 fetal anomalies between 26 and 36 weeks in the past 5 years. This means that Tiller alone did 2,000 partial birth abortions every single year, and only 8% of them were for birth defects. Remember the previous quote by the National Abortion Federation claiming that only 500 were done every year in the entire country? I guess it's true the lie has to have a good memory. The National Abortion Federation certainly does not. All of this lying caused Ron Fitzsimmons, executive director of the National Coalition of Abortion Providers, to complain, "When you're a doctor who does these abortions and the leaders of your movement appear before Congress and go on network news and say these procedures are done in only the most tragic of circumstances, how do you think it makes you feel? You know they're done primarily on healthy women and healthy fetuses, and it makes you feel like a dirty little abortionist with a dirty little secret. I think we should tell them the truth, let them vote, and move on." Once again, the Pro-Abortion Guttmacher Institute kindly gives us the truth, backed up by statistics. These are the reasons women have late-term abortions based upon asking them in interviews. She misjudged gestation of the child, 31%. It was hard for me to arrange the abortion, 27%. I was afraid to tell my parents or partner, 14%. I took my time deciding, 9%. I was waiting for a relationship change that didn't happen, 4%. Someone pressured me to wait, 2%. Something changed after I learned I was pregnant, 1%. I didn't know I could get a late abortion, 2%. Fetal anomaly, 1%. Other reasons, 9%. Remember that Planned Parenthood claimed that all partial birth abortions are done for fatal birth defects or to save the life of the mother? It turns out that the actual number is about 1%. Pro-abortionists often dismiss pro-life concerns by saying that there are only a few third trimester abortions done every year. Now, it's true that only a small percentage of abortions are performed in the third trimester, but the number of abortions that have been done is so huge that even 1% is a large number. Since the first states legalized abortion in 1967, there have been 55,128,000 legal abortions done in the United States as of January the 1st of this year. This means that 5.5 million abortions have been done in the second trimester, 581,600 in the third trimester, more than 500,000, almost all of them, on perfectly healthy babies of perfectly healthy mothers. And then, of course, we have what the pro-choice people like to call fourth trimester abortions. Kermit Gosnell routinely delivered full-term babies in his filthy Philadelphia abortion mill and then severed their spinal columns with scissors. This was done with the full knowledge of the National Abortion Federation, which had inspected his clinic, and other pro-abortionists. Not one major so-called pro-choice group has condemned Gosnell. They are willing to say that he is the exception, not the rule, and that's as far as they're willing to go. The seventh media myth about abortion is that most Americans are pro-choice. This has been repeated by the corrupt media and by pro-abortion advertising campaigns so many times it has become what we call common knowledge. Everyone knows it's true, but really don't know why it's true. At first glance, it may seem that Americans are indeed pro-choice. Almost every poll taken shows that Americans support the Roe v. Wade decision that legalizes abortion. But the media, which seems so eager to dig deeper regarding every other topic, is notoriously slothful when it comes to abortion. If the immediate, fleeting first impression agrees with their own pro-abortion worldview, corrupt and lazy reporters have no motivation to dig any deeper. If we think beyond the superficial level that most reporters are stuck at, we find something very interesting. Typically, polls represent Roe v. Wade as legalizing abortion in the first trimester only. Typical wording in such a poll is the October 2007 Harris poll, which stated, and this is a quote, "In 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that state laws which made it illegal for a woman to have an abortion up to 3 months of pregnancy were unconstitutional, and that the decision on whether a woman should have an abortion up to 3 months of pregnancy should be left to the woman and her doctor to decide. In general, do you favor or oppose this part of the U.S. Supreme Court decision making abortions up to 3 months of pregnancy legal?" End of quote. Notice the strong emphasis on the phrase 3 months of pregnancy, which is repeated 3 times in just one short paragraph, deliberately giving the impression that abortion is legal for just 3 months instead of the reality, which is that it's legal throughout all 9 months of pregnancy. The result of this particular poll was that 56% supported Roe v. Wade and 40% thought that it should be overturned. Now, to get a better grasp of what Americans really think about abortion, we look to the Gallup Trending Opinion poll on the topic. This poll asks exactly the same question. Not a single word has changed about abortion year after year of a large number of people. This means that we can get an accurate feel for the changing attitudes of Americans towards abortion. The most revealing question of this poll is, with respect to the abortion issue, would you consider yourself to be pro-choice or pro-life? In 1995, only 33% of Americans described themselves as pro-life and 56% described themselves as pro-choice. But ever since 1995, pro-lifers have been gaining ground. In fact, in 2012, exactly half of Americans described themselves as pro-life, a huge gain of 17%, or exactly 1% per year. Meanwhile, only 41% of Americans describe themselves as pro-choice, a loss of nearly 1% a year and 15% less in 1995. This shows that pro-life efforts are having a huge effect. The partial birth abortion battle horrified Americans and had a large influence, but pro-lifers are also developing an alternative media that's reaching millions of people. The nation's 3,000 crisis pregnancy centers are educating about 2 million young women a year about fetal development and about abortion alternatives. And, of course, we have demographics. Pro-life families simply have more children than pro-abortion families. The Gallup Trending poll on abortion shows that pro-lifers have made significant gains in 18 out of 19 categories over the time period 2001 to 2012 among men, among women, all age groups, all levels of education, all areas of the nation, and in all political parties. The only category which is less pro-life is atheists, and even then, there's a loss of only 1 point. In 2001, 52% of men described themselves as pro-life. Now 57% do, for a gain of 5%. In 2001, 51% of women described themselves as pro-life. Now it's 55%, a gain of 4%. Young people in the ages 18 to 34, 47% considered themselves pro-life in 2001. Now it's 54%, a gain of 7%. College graduates, 43% in 2001, a gain of 10% to 53% now. Christians have gone from 57% to 62% pro-life, or a gain of 5%. Independent voters, 30% in 2001, 47% in 2012, for a huge gain of 17%. Now, as we saw before, hard case abortions make up only about 3% of all abortions done. Not surprisingly, Americans support these abortions by various margins, but they do not support abortions for social reasons. Americans support abortions to save the life of the mother by an 83% to 13% margin. But these abortions are only about 1 out of 600 of all abortions. They support abortions to preserve the woman's health by a margin of 82 to 15%. But these abortions only make up about 1 out of 120 of the abortions that are performed. They support abortions to preserve the mental health of the mother by 61 to 35%. These are about 1 out of 80 of all abortions done. They support the availability of eugenic abortions for serious birth defects, which comprise only about 1 out of 160 abortions. Finally, they support abortions for rape and incest by 75% to 22%, but these are only about 1 out of 800 abortions. In summary, then, Americans support the hard case abortions, which make up about 3% of all of the procedures done. But Americans oppose the 97% of abortions that are done for social, economics, or convenience reasons by a margin of 61% to 36%. For example, we don't like the 82% of all abortions that are done on unmarried women. As we might expect, most Americans support first trimester abortions, which follows from the polls that say most Americans support Roe v. Wade, as long as a false impression is given that it legalized abortions in the first trimester only. But large majorities of Americans think that second trimester abortion should be banned by a huge margin of 71 to 24%, and we think third trimester abortion should be illegal by a crushing 86 to 10% margin. When we start to talk about these poll results, all of a sudden pro-abortionists tend to want to change the subject. Americans also favor various laws intended to protect the health and informed consent of women. Yet pro-abortionists oppose all of these measures in court, showing they really don't care about the public opinion polls unless they can somehow be spun as supporting abortion. A 24-hour waiting period before an abortion is supported by 69 to 28%. Girls under 18, parental consent, 71 to 27% support it. Informed consent for the woman on the dangers of abortion, 87% favor, 11% oppose. She must see an ultrasound before an abortion. We favor this by 50 to 46%. Husband must be notified of wife's abortion. We support this by 64 to 34%. And women should be informed of alternatives to abortion, 88 to 11% approval. What does all this mean in the long run? It means this. If abortion was put to a national referendum tomorrow, Americans would vote to ban 97% of all abortions. The eighth media myth about abortion is that men have no right to speak out against it. Well, the old hypocrisy meter is definitely pegged on this one. Pro-abortion people tell us all the time about how men should just shut the heck up and butt out of the abortion decision because it's her body and she can do whatever she wants to with it. As one example on one smarmy Saturday Night Live episode, Nassim Pedrid said, "If men could get pregnant, abortion clinics would be like Starbucks. There'd be two on every block and four in every airport, and the morning after pill would come in different flavors like sea salt and cool ranch," all while a smirking Seth Meyers watched. As we've already shown, the unborn child is certainly not part of a woman's body. This is a regressive and unscientific opinion. Of course, a pro-abortionist will certainly not tell you to shut up if you're a man and you speak out for abortion. In 1973, 9 old men on the Supreme Court of the United States gave us abortion on demand. Did the feminists tell them to shut up and butt out because they couldn't get pregnant? And we've had a parade of predatory United States senators from Lightning Lips Bob Packwood of Oregon to Teddy Bear Kennedy of Massachusetts talking about abortion constantly. And it was common knowledge that Arizona abortionist Brian Finkel raped and sexually abused scores of his abortion patients while they were unconscious during his procedures. But despite their preying on women, these men were welcomed at pro-choice rallies, which shows you where their priorities lie. With pro-abortion zealots, abortion always ranks ahead of the health and welfare of women. If you're male and pro-choice, you've matured in your view on women's sexuality, they say. If you're male and pro-life, you hate women. It's as simple as that. That is how central abortion is to their mentality. But the validity and the truth of an argument has absolutely nothing to do with a person's sex, age, race, or any other variable. If a statement or an argument is true, then it's true. It doesn't matter who's saying it. Anyone who says that men may not speak out against abortion is by definition anti-male. Pro-abortion leaders say that since men can't get pregnant, then they should have no voice about abortion. But many of their women leaders are beyond the age where they can have children, so it gives them the right to speak out for abortion. Nancy Pelosi, a so-called Catholic who pushes abortion relentlessly, is 73 years old. Molly Yard, former president of the National Organization for Women, was 83 years old when she died, and she was still pushing abortion. Frances Kissling, longtime president of the pro-abortion group Catholics for a Free Choice, is 70 years old. Kate Michaelman, former head of NARAL Pro-Choice America, is also 70 years old. Faye Waddleton, former president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, the largest chain of abortion mills in the country, is 69 years old. They can't get pregnant any more than men can. Also, what about pro-abortion women of childbearing age who have been sterilized? If men can't speak on abortion because they can't get pregnant, then women should not speak out about war if they can't be in an armed force. White people should not speak out about racism if they've not been discriminated against, and women should be prohibited from speaking about sports that only include men. These parallel arguments show just how illogical this pro-abortion, women-only argument really is. The ninth media myth about abortion is you can't legislate morality. This has to be one of the silliest assertions made by the pro-abortion movement. Of course we can legislate morality. This is the purpose of every law that has ever been written. If anyone ever tells you that you can't legislate morality, you can stop them cold by asking them to name a law that does not legislate morality in some way. To say that we can't legislate morality means advocacy of absolute and total anarchy. The extensive legislating of morality is absolutely essential to the survival of any society. One person of this slogan is to try to cast abortion, euthanasia, pornography, and other issues as church-state conflicts. People who use this media myth assert that anyone who tries to outlaw some immoral act is doing so out of a purely religious motivation. This is an attempt to sideline religious believers from the political process, and we must not tolerate it. Most of our laws are based on the Ten Commandments. Does this mean that we should throw them all away? Thou shalt not kill. Laws against murder, manslaughter, negligent homicide, attempted suicide, mutilation of both living and dead persons, possession of unregistered firearms, drunkenness, drunken driving, reckless endangerment, kidnapping, and the sale and use of illegal or dangerous drugs. Thou shalt not steal. Laws against robbery, fraud, shoplifting, stealing, larceny, theft, insider trading, and embezzlement. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Laws against libel, slander, and perjury, lying under oath. All of these laws legislate morality, and all of them are based on the Ten Commandments. The tenth and last media myth about abortion that we'll discuss today is, every child must be a wanted child. Pro-abortion people believe that unwantedness leads to abuse, and that if all children are wanted, child abuse will decrease. However, if a child's degree of desirability to its parents is a measure of its worth, then it's simply dehumanized and made into an object. Right after abortion was legalized in the United States, NARAL heartlessly seized on the epidemic of child abuse as an excuse to promote abortion. It said that legal abortion would decrease the number of unwanted children, battered children, child abuse cases, and possibly subsequent delinquency, drug addiction, and a host of social ills believed to be associated with neglectful parenthood. The opinion that children are only valued as much as they're wanted obviously opens the door to child abuse. For example, abortion has increased, not decreased, the number of child abuse cases in the United States. The reported rate of child abuse in the USA has tripled from 1972 to 1995, and the rate of fatal child abuse cases also tripled during this time period. In 1972, the year before Roe v. Wade, cases of substantiated child abuse were less than 200,000. In 1995, they'd gone up by a factor of 5 to 1 million. The child abuse rate per 1,000 children was 2.9 in 1972. That also went up by a factor of 5 in 1995 to 14.6. The Wanted Child slogan is truly hideous because it assigns worth to human life based purely on the whim of another person, in this case, a child's mother. Naturally, this logic could also be applied to born children just as easily it could to reborn children. Not surprisingly, the rate of murders of newborn children and infants in the United States has also increased drastically since abortion was legalized in 1973. Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta said that saying that there are too many children is like saying that there are too many flowers. What brings greater joy and innocence to the world than a sweet little baby or toddler? In conclusion, what the pro-life movement needs now is prayer and new people. We can expand the size and power of the pro-life movement by bringing new people into it. Everyone listening to this talk knows two or three people who are sympathetic to the plight of the unborn but are not involved. This is usually because they have one or two problems with our philosophy or with the pro-life movement as it's portrayed by the corrupt mainstream media. Such uninvolved people might think that the pro-life movement is unsympathetic towards rape or incest victims, or that there are too many people in the world, or since most people support abortion, it must be all right. If you learn the topic and gently persuade these uninvolved people that their beliefs about the pro-life movement are incorrect, you have a much greater chance of bringing them into activism, whether it be street activities or crisis pregnancy center work. If you'd like to have a complete course on self-instruction on how to debunk the 40 most common pro-abortion slogans, including the 10 discussed today, please email Brian Close at bclowes@hli.org. Thank you, and may God bless you.
We hope you have enjoyed this presentation of Human Life International. For more information about HLI's mission, please see our website at www.hli.org. That's www.hli.org. Those listeners who wish to order more copies of this recording or other pro-life materials can call us at 1-800-549-LIFE. That's 1-800-549-LIFE.